Iambic Audiobooks and Akashic Books presents Suicide Casanova by Arthur Nersessian, read by Mark F. Smith. Part 1. Rewind. April 13th, 2001, NYC. Except for the fact that it terminates life, death is such a little thing. Muscles cease to twitch, cells fail to regenerate, the body rots. Accidents are the perfect murder. Even the murderer doesn't know he's committing them, until he finds the little gag ball of guilt somewhere inside himself. Opportunity was obvious, but I'm still trying to ascertain motive. Dead skin. That's the primary ingredient of dust. My dearly departed would never have tolerated the fine skin of dust that now veils her room. Two cheesy paperbacks on her desktop say it all. The Disciplined Gentleman and Love Bound. Pop psychology attempts at explaining the phenomenon that my wife had turned into her deadlyhood. She was forever curious about what drove sensitive, educated, wealthy men to her velvet rack. In the 2 months since she died, I haven't once stepped inside her chamber, a spacious kitchen until she had the stove, sink, and fridge removed and it was converted into her office. We always ate out. Although she had impeccable taste, she always kept the room bare and functional. A large mission-style desk, 2 4-drawer filing cabinets against the far wall, a color TV with a VCR. No paintings, lamps, or knick-knacks. A stack of boxes held the paraphernalia from her now-defunct dungeon. For the first time, I am recalling her beautiful face, minutes dead, with Lana's drool and lipstick still slobbered around her mouth. Her blue lips, that red flush rising up from the black leather neck collar which was still dug deep into her throat. Her eyes, shocked, bulging up from death, eternally astounded as she gagged on that little red ball. I draw the drapes in her office just a bit so that a poker of sunlight stabs across the wall, illuminating her oak bookshelf. Early editions in Mylar covers and box sets that she ordered over the internet. Collector's copies of De Sade, de Maupassant, Flaubert, Zola, Jarry, Artaud. Toward the last month she was buying up French naturalists, working her way to the surrealists. The bottom shelf is lined with videotapes, boxed and labeled. When the phone rings in the next room, I can hear Beckwith's combed-over voice on the answering machine, asking how the new medication is working. Fine. That's why I'm not speaking to you, asshole. Her videos are mainly old Hollywood flicks. Preston Sturges and John Huston films are among her favorites. There are some documentaries, Chicken Hawk, about NAMBLA, and Ken Burns's Civil War series. Yes, she was a dues-paying member of PBS. A lot of the tapes are TV shows she used to pull herself out of her moods. Seinfeld, The Simpsons, that sort of thing. There are roughly half a dozen porn films, mainly S&M, some starring friends and associates. She used to say that they gave her ideas for work. In the late 70s, I used to be addicted to these films. Each one was a little amyl nitrite rush. Back then, watching hours of grainy porn in filthy, alkaline-smelling booths for about a quarter per minute, it would only cost about $1 before I would come. On a horny afternoon, I could even do it for 50 cents. Nowadays, I go broke having to pay by the minute, and with video technology, a sultan's orgy can be copied for peanuts. Beckwith is still whining on my answering machine, pleading for me to return his calls. Did the court appoint me to look after him, or vice versa? I have a theory about these latter-day priests. To appease their own guilt, they search out their confessions in the mouths of their patients. Why else would Beckwith be so insistent? You need help, Leslie, please. Well, he's not getting shit out of me. Hidden sideways behind the videos, I see it. Teacher's Pet, a porn flick starring the great 70s diva, Skye Pacifica. My wife knew that I was once involved with Skye. After we got married, though, we never talked much about it. All she ever knew was that I had had a relationship with her, and that it had gone sour. I feel badly that she had apparently gone out of her way to inspect my former fuck. In truth, Skye was a lot of things. Con woman, charity case, object of idolatry, but I can barely remember ever making love to her. Were their firmly balanced breasts only eclipsed by her perfectly looped thighs, her holy body seemed the product of a salacious cosmetic surgeon's fantasy. But it was her face that stole the show. I simply couldn't get enough of it. For that matter, I couldn't get a fix on it. It seemed to change constantly, reflecting and refracting at various angles as if made of fleshy sequins. Skye epitomized pornography by being not just one drop-dead knockout, but at different angles, reminiscent of all of them. Early in her career she was thin. Later she grew curvaceous. She was brunette, but at times would go blonde. Despite what legally had to be called wild infidelities on my dear wife's part, I never doubted her loyalties for an instant, and I never sensed a hint of her jealousy of me. Well, maybe just a hint. Toward the end, on that final night anyway, the M.E. said the mouthpiece was loose enough she should have been able to spit the ball out. There's only one reason she didn't stop it. She died despite me. In every relationship, to paraphrase Auden, doesn't one partner love the other just a bit more? Through the course of our relationship, I wondered if I was the one more or less loved. I was always testing her. If I had found this tape of Skye earlier, well, this is the pigeon feather that imbalanced the wings of our affection. During our marriage, it had never occurred to me to reconnect with Skye. But now, the thought of seeing her sensuously penetrated makes me catch my breath. They try to teach sex offenders to avoid these pesky erotic triggers, and this tape is the button to a nuclear warhead. In the kitchen, I locate a can opener in a can. Tuna fish. Lunch. I frantically start hooking and twisting. My obsession with Skye started when I purchased every loop of hers I could get my sticky hands on, and there were plenty. Skye used three separate professional identities early in her career. I located four films in which she acted under the name Blue June. As Blue, she was at her youngest, undoubtedly a minor. She had more of a girlish body, puffy breasts, a mischievous smile, gangly limbs, a torso not yet developed enough for its final erotic destiny. Her next nom de femme was Sarah Moreau. She was more self-conscious as an actress, her style more aggressive, less content to lie still and be done unto. Under this identity, her physique was a bit more mature. Her breasts were still filling out, but the bony edges of her shoulders, ribcage, and knees contrasted with the spring baby fat padded over all else. One film called Missy's Tizzy featured young Skye under the playful pseudonym Sue DeGrasse. She appeared adolescent and smutty, like a naughty little girl who had been playing with her mother's cosmetics. There's a familiar fantasy. She confused trashiness with promiscuity and promiscuity with sophistication. Trying to open the tuna fish, my fingers start trembling. Fuck tuna. Returning to the fresh dust of Cecilia's room, I look on her desktop blotter. Bills to late middle-aged men whose flabby asses she'd whip raw, lucky lads. An unmailed warranty for a cellular phone she'd never use. I spot a photograph of Britney Spears clipped out of some magazine, a reminder of youth eternal. Able to resist no longer, I pop teacher's pet into the VCR and barely touch the play button. There she is, or was, young Skye Pacifica. Not much more than 16 years old, but easily passing for 18, pre-Tracy Lords. Teacher's pet is about a student who needs an after-school tutorial. Sure she does. Right away she establishes a puppy crush on her much older teacher. Her red and white striped panties peek out whenever she bends over for a pencil. We know where she's heading. Too bad the adult entertainment industry only uses plot as a shield, the old First Amendment defense. Back in the Golden Age, most porn sagged toward satire or campy dramatic. If the scenarios were just slightly credible, instead of opening around attractive, overly coiffed couples who happened to be sitting naked in hot tubs, and if the sex started out a bit awkwardly, even begrudgingly, instead of reducing the sacred act into something as blasé as a handshake, the orgasm would have spurted so much further. Over the past 10 years, the closest device the industry has come up with has been the straightforward interview, dropping all pretense and artifice, which has actually been quite an innovation, since the actors speaking off the cuff are usually brighter and more interesting than the characters that were formerly scripted. On the other hand, porn actresses nowadays, with their dyed-blonde bouffants, phony tits, collagen lips, plucked eyebrows, and shaved pubes, usually look alike and can't get me hard. In Teacher's Pet, the young and hairless Skye is chit-chatting for far too long with the older teacher. The fast-forward button cuts through all that tedious exposition. Then play. Her pink little tongue is licking the salt off the droopy, goat-like testicles of a man more than twice her age. Hairy, fat, and lecherous, he probably smells like a colostomy bag. The divining rod in my pants is my first erection in some time, and it's pointing to the past. December 2, 1979, NYC. A distant and sporadic tweaking on the very brink of her still consciousness grew louder and more intrusive, until Skye finally opened her eyes. It was the repeated honking and screeching of traffic. "Where the fuck am I?" she thought. She sat up, filled with dread. Seeing a guy sleeping next to her, she wondered if another horny bastard had got a free fuck while she was under. She reached down and was glad to find that her panties were still on. Regardless, her self-disgust turned to self-loathing and suddenly erupted as she slapped herself hard across the face. Why was she always doing this shit? She scratched her fingers down her face just short of tearing the skin, and finally boiled out, "What the fuck am I doing here?" The guy next to her bolted up. She had now compounded her fuck-up. He swiveled his legs down and sat at the bed's edge. She could have rooted around while he was still asleep. He might have had some cash. Then she could have just taken it and split. "What's the matter?" he said, still half asleep. "My fucking life." "Come on, you're only 23. 22, asshole." That was her second mistake. Don't insult strangers. She still had a scar on her chin from the time she had blithely insulted a Turkish importer with a callous cock. As a pressure built up behind Skye's eyes, she tried to push it back, but it was too much. All at once she seemed to give birth to woe. Tears flowed through her hands. She knew she was making her third mistake by crying, but she couldn't stop. When he opened the blinds, revealing a sunny new day, she restrained herself from shouting at him to leave them closed. The grief was turning her ugly, making her face splotchy red, diminishing her beauty and therefore her power. But in another moment the room began to feel humid with her tears. All self-consciousness was washed away, and she stared starkly at the question, "What am I going to do?" "Maybe you need to eat something," he said, responding to his own hunger. "I'm never hungry in the morning, asshole," she shot back. "So now I know," he replied meekly. She muttered, "Sorry," and remembered all the sleeping pills. That was why she felt particularly lousy. The man prepared and slid a cup of coffee next to her. She rose to the wooden cabinet, grabbed a bottle of Jack Daniels, spun open the black top so that it fell to the floor, and took a hard gulp before the guy pulled the bottle away. Finally, she recognized him. It was the geek with the girl's name. He had met her by pretending to be a photographer. Harmless. "Why does my head hurt so much?" she asked, feeling a sensitive rise in her scalp. The hot glow of Jack inside of her immediately did its job. "You probably have a hangover," he said stiffly. "Why do I have a bump?" She wondered what he had done with her last night. She remembered boarding a plane with him in California, but she didn't remember landing. "Look," the guy replied, "do you recall what we discussed in L.A.? You said that at the end of this year you wanted a second chance." She sat perfectly still like a child being scolded. "You said you wanted to do something more with your life in 1980 than just fucking, coking, and partying." She sighed. Yesterday morning she'd fled the West Coast. She remembered that he had proposed helping her get her life back on track. At the time, it had sounded like a good idea. Now, she silently thought, okay. Things aren't so bad. I can call Janine. She lives here somewhere. I can get a dance gig, save some money, and within the month, get my own place and be free of this geek. She shook her head in contrite agreement, mumbled a brief apology, and said, look, I'm really embarrassed to be asking this, but I forgot your name. Leslie, he replied. April 13, 2001, NYC. With the help of the porn video, I remember Skye's beautiful lips. Her jaws seemed to dislocate like a snake's when she swallowed. When my reddened member spurts further and hotter than it has since I was a teen, I realize, hallelujah, I'm cured! At that moment, at that place deep inside where primal decisions aren't so much figured out as recognized, I know that I have to locate her. Checking my wife's old Rolodex, flipping through her slap-and-tickle clientele, I locate Ron Marauder, the sole proprietor of a private investigation agency he calls the Dogs of War. Beyond all the clandestine information Ronnie has gathered in his lifetime, it's ironic that I know his one big secret. Strong and quiet by day, he is a whining, diaper-wetting infantilist in the wee hours of the night. I dial his beeper and get a return call within 15 minutes. "Leslie, is everything okay?" Ron asked nervously. "Sure. Before I forget, I gave Cecilia an unlicensed handgun. Can you look through her things and give it back?" "I packed up all her stuff, and I don't recall seeing any handgun," I respond peacefully. "If you find it, hold it for me," he replies, and returns to square one. "So why'd you beep?" "Ron, I have another job for you." "No way, I don't do shit like that. The only reason I did the last one was for Cecilia." "It's nothing like that. I'm just trying to locate an old friend." "I am trying my best not to hold you responsible for Cecilia's death. I think you know that I loved your wife. Twice I asked her to leave you and marry me." "I don't know what to say," I reply flatly. "I gave her the gun to blow your brains out," he shouts. "No half-decent husband would have allowed her to do what she did. You obviously didn't give a shit about her." "Maybe so," I respond with dejection. Perhaps it was due to the furious devotion of slaves like Ron that Cecilia was always attracted to my cool ambivalence. "Truth of the matter is," he finally resumes, "I've been walking around like a zombie since she died." Silence, and then I hear him crying. "Ron," I interrupt, "if it's of any consolation, I would gladly have traded my life for hers." "If I didn't believe that, I'd stab your eyes out," he says sincerely, and then adds, "Motherfucker!" All that out of the way, we arrange a time, later that week, and a place, a macrobiotic restaurant, to discuss my case. Over herbal teas, I give Ron some old photos and all the information I know about Skye Pacifica. Her real name is Jean. I last remember that she was married to a guy named Eddie Lindemeyer and had given birth to a baby girl named Kate. "Have you checked the internet?" Ron asked. "No." I warm my hands against the tea mug. "You know, I must have earned $10,000 alone just going through the net," he reflects. "You don't say," I feign fascination. "Leslie, was that Shirley Temple guy someone important?" "Not really. If it makes you feel better, nothing came of it." "You've got to promise me something up front. There's no hanky-panky in this case. I'm not going to jeopardize losing my permit." "It's nothing like the last case." "It's personal," he clarifies, not business. Exactly. Keeping a business tone is a safe bet when dealing with this nut. Ron shakes my hand and leaves, refusing to commit to how long this will take. Once, years ago, someone from L.A., a cancerous porn producer named Philip, hunted me down. He was like an incestuous father to Sky, and he wanted his little girl back. It took him several months to track me. By then, Sky was gone. A few months later, Philip was dead. December 16, 1998, NYC. Standing outside the playroom at her dungeon, Excalibur's, Mistress Guinevere, a.k.a. Cecilia, kept reminding herself that the camcorder was hidden in the closet on the upper shelf. Her frame was to the right of the wall cuff and left of the rack. She had to keep him within this range. She checked her wristwatch and listened. When she heard the tinkling of her beauty aids, she opened the door violently, just as he liked, and looked at him sitting before the antique vanity, staring into the large beveled mirror. Sure enough, he had taken out her mascara and left it scattered over the quilted lace on top, as he had done every second week since 1982. He'd even managed to apply some of the lipstick. "Who made this fucking mess?" she said, right on cue, slapping his hand and tossing the lipstick, eyeliner, and nail polish back into the cosmetic bag. "Honey, sorry, Mommy," he began slowly in his high-pitched falsetto. "She's so sorry. Please don't hit your honey bunny." The prick was deliberately slowing the pace to annoy her. "Every fucking time I turn around, you make a mess." She delivered her line with authentic rage while wiping his face, smearing the lipstick on his cheek. "Honey's so sorry. Honey will never make a naughty mess again." She hated this. The Honorable Peter Sanders, Administrative Judge of the Southern District of New York Bankruptcy Court, had been her unwanted slave for over 15 years. Finally, after so long, she had turned the tables. She was planning to extort him with the hidden camera. In 1984, when she had first opened up her own dungeon, she informed him that she was slimming down her clientele. She politely offered to set him up with another mistress. But Judge Sanders grew livid. He would have none of it. When she explained that she simply couldn't see him any longer, he threatened to shut her down, and she knew he had the clout. "Honey's going to have a seriously sore ass this time," she said, and cursed herself for adding the word seriously, which was not in the script. Whether it was due to boredom or nervousness, she would usually slip in an extemporaneous word. She quickly added, "Put your hands behind your back, right now!"
"Yes, Mommy."
She took a long leather sash, roped it around his wrists several times, making hard knots the way he liked it. "Now bend over," she commanded. No sooner had he bent over the usual chair than she heard him mutter, "Oh, shit, my bifocals!" She was waiting for that. Last week it was a runny nose. The week before, the sash was too tight. "Screw your glasses," she replied. Each week he deliberately needled her, always in different ways.
"No," he said softly. "Mercy."
She slumped when he said the safe word.
"I have to have my glasses on or I can't see what's going on. Now untie my hands."
"I'll put them on for you." She reached down and was about to place them on the bridge of his narrow, fleshless nose.
"Mercy! I fucking said mercy! Are you an idiot?"
She leaned her head down and sighed.
"I asked if you are an idiot," he barked.
"No," she said, demurring to him.
"Untie my hands and be quick about it, then."
"I'm only trying to save you time and money," she mumbled contritely, as she untied the sash around his wrists. Under his breath, he whispered, "Idiot." Initially, he was the perfect slave. On time, reticent, not too weird, predictable. Over the years, he had slowly grown contrary. Gradually, she lost control and slipped into this groove. She felt a twinge of embarrassment that this was being filmed. Once every 2 weeks, in the strangest of ways, she was unintentionally being victimized by this knobby little man. And now she wanted out. Her husband Leslie had known all along that the bankruptcy judge was her client. He had listened to her repeated gripes about the slave who was holding her captive. But not until the last few months had he taken an interest in the man. When he finally sat down and proposed the plan of extortion, she jumped at it, not for the money, but in hope of being free of Sanders. "The sooner I get my glasses on, the sooner we can get back to the business at hand," he said very properly as Cecilia finished untying the sash. The old man fetched his eyeglasses and planted them on his nose. Resuming his former posture, he refitted the curly Goldilocks wig on his balding scalp and lifted his ridiculously short red polka-dot skirt above his flaccid hairless ass. "Ready," he said, and crossed his wrists again behind his back. She retied the sash tightly. "Someone's going to have a sore ass," she continued.
"Please, don't hurt honey too badly," he said in a plaintive tone.
Cecilia spanked the judge across his bare, bony bottom with the hairbrush and wondered if her stance was casting a shadow, obscuring the light. Was Ron getting all this on the videotape? April 22, 2001, NYC. Times Square was formerly Longacre Square, around 100 years ago, when the theater district was on 14th Street and the New York Times offices were who remembers where. This section of town was empty. My law firm, which occupied the top floor of the old Longacre building, 1472 Broadway, right at 42nd and 7th, was one of the first casualties of the neighborhood's overhaul. Now we are housed in the city's hottest new skyscraper, the Condé Nast building at 4 Times Square, a shiny silver missile silo that looks out over other shiny silver missile silos. Maybe it's no coincidence that right in the center of Times Square is the Zipper. The neighborhood for years was one thinly concealed erection. Although everything else has been replaced, the Zipper is still there. Before the new Times Square, 42nd Street had about 50 sex parlors between 7th and 8th Avenues, with a Warner Brothers store where my dick used to be, at the front of the old Allied Chemical building, and a Disney store in my balls, where my favorite porn arcade was. I feel as though I'd had a concrete and steel vasectomy. I, like most of the old-timers, still prefer my Petri dish out in the open, quintessential New York City. Ironically, if old Times Square has gone anywhere, it is trans-cyberized onto the Internet. It unites Bangkok, Thailand to Blue Balls, Pennsylvania, through a Byzantine funhouse of boutique websites and transvestite chat rooms. Anyone at any age can anonymously log on in the privacy of his or her living room. In all my most perverted dreams, I would never have imagined such a wonderful and wicked creation. Vulgar old Times Square with its sticky porn shops and infected whores would never have allowed the sick shit that I've downloaded to my computer screen. Fetishes aren't merely catered to, with all the sexual specialties, they are encouraged. Think I'm kidding? Start your search engine and type hairy plus Asian plus grannies. Something will pop up. Even in its vilest, most medieval days, you couldn't get that service on 42nd Street. People need their dirty habits, if only to shame them into their clean habits. I regard the sanitizing of Times Square, and, for that matter, the censoring of municipal art, as not much more than the kinkiest fetish of Mr. Giuliani and his lovable cronies. Still, you can cut the leaves and even the branches, but the roots are still down there. The once bushy center of New York has now been entirely defoliated. They've installed a series of windows, an outdoor MTV window, the ESPN zone. Backdrops for ABC's Good Morning America and various other live TV sound stages. Fresh-faced youngsters fill the street with banners of encouragement and greetings. 20 years ago, they would have been shanghaied by pimps and chicken hawks. This city reinvents itself every 30 years or so. If the juvenile crap cross-pollinates with the old sleaze, this place might become the kiddie-porn capital by 2030. The metallic aerial at the top of the Empire State Building looks like a big syringe, and I feel it in my system. The commotion and distraction of New York is my heroin addiction. I don't remember not being strung out on stomach-turning anxiety, and though I initially found it thrilling, I subsequently hated it. Now, I can't live without it. The crowd. My eyes flip from face to ephemeral face. They part like a fleshy oriental fan dance. Old faces move aside, revealing new faces behind. Beauty turns, blends, bleeds into different types of prettiness. I think of them like word groups, homonym faces that sound like other faces but mean something else, synonym faces that nuance into similar faces, antonym faces that starkly contrast, new anagram faces that rearrange into former faces. Soon such subtleties fall away, a deck shuffle of polar faces, young, old, black, white, masculine, feminine, blemish, clear, shadowing, light-emitting. I collect a pair of eyes here, a set of lips there. Finally feeling that rumble below my feet, I dash down the stairs and catch a crowded subway to 72nd. A bottleneck of bodies crowds around one of the narrow stairways on the 72nd Street station. There's blockage. People are creeping up single file. A homeless man is obstructing passage, leaning against the banister. I study his pitted face. He definitely looks like a Wilbur. His eyes are reddening. His breathing is growing more labored by the second. It's hypnotic watching him become un-Wilbered. An invisible noose is slowly tightening around this man's wretched neck. As he makes it up just the first few steps, a local train pours into the station. Several large men lumber down the stairs, pushing him back onto the platform. Within seconds, waves of people are shoving their way out of the disemboweling train, forcing him upward. He's trying to resist. His swollen hands are like the aged suctions of some sea creature. He's trying to hold on to the banister. I can hear him emitting a phlegmy rasp. He gasps dramatically for several minutes. He knows he's being watched. Finally, he stumbles downward and lowers himself to the filthy concrete platform, leaning up against a blue post. He closes his eyes. In another moment, he topples to his side. A small crowd forms. "Call an ambulance!" someone barks. An Indian lady in an indigo suit flies up the steps to the street-level token booth. I've seen these histrionics before on the part of the homeless and their ongoing drive to waste the time of others. But inspecting Wilbur's countenance, a series of sharp, jerky twitches, bright redness draining into pale, drool unspooling onto the ground, I see that he truly is unconscious. "He's having an asthma attack," I say, and strictly for appearances I call out, "Does anyone have any Primatene mist?" Of course they don't. A young lady in distressed denim and cheap perfume unclips a small compact and holds the mirror to Wilbur's scraggy mouth. "His breathing is shallow," she hoots. "An ambulance is on its way," some voice consoles. "Are you kidding?" a more realistic perspective cries out. "In this city, with the average response time during rush hour, forget it." I take a deep gulp of air, lean over, and lift Wilbur. "You can get sued for that," some ancillary voice chides. "An ambulance is on its way," someone else pipes up as I steal away everyone's opportunity for cheap heroics. He is one heavy load. Struggling to haul the body up the stairs, I feel someone helping. It is the cheaply perfumed lady with the compact. She grabs one of Wilbur's crooked legs. By the time we are halfway up the steps, clinging to the unpainted wooden banister, another man joins in. When we get to the sidewalk, the three of us are panting. "This way!" I yell, pushing through in-pouring commuters moving along the curb and sidewalk. We stumble, walk, run in unsynchronized steps, pulling and thrusting the inert man held out before us. Suddenly, right behind us, a car honks. "Fuck you!" I yell as reflex. He honks again. It is a yellow cab. The vehicle is driven by a bearded Pakistani in a tan turban, hollering for us to get in the back. All three of us pile in with our stinky body. Once inside Roosevelt Hospital, through the waiting room, my two compadres and I start screaming for help. Two hefty attendants center Wilbur on a gurney. Without words, my posse vanishes. He's having an asthma attack, I diagnose aloud, before I too evaporate into the crowd. When I eventually meander into the lobby of my apartment building, I find my charity has been rewarded. A manila envelope sits in the mailbox with an invoice for $350. Ron has located Sky Pacifica in Suffolk County, Long Island, in the small town of Borden, closer to South Shore Crass than North Shore Attitude. It has taken Ron just over a week. An information form lists her home address, home phone number, work address, a short profile of her husband, Eddie, and several details about his business. Subsequent pages give a brief description of the two children, along with where they go to school. Just like Sky, her daughter Kate has exhibited little penchant for formal education. At age 19, she has flunked two grades and remains a pouty, sullen high schooler. Several long shots of her and the family are included. The best photo shows Sky Pacifica getting into her car. It's the first time I've seen her in 15 years. Now Jean Lindemeyer, soccer mom, is flave of the day. Poor dear Sky, porn queen, has melted away. I stare at the photos. Vigor, intelligence, style are qualities that crystallized in place of the youthful filament of innocence that once glowed from her skin. Her daughter Kate is equally remarkable. Jean's pageant-perfect bone structure beneath a smoky brown skin. I keep staring at the photos as I take the elevator up to my apartment. Once inside, I lock the door and play my machine. Bill Holtov, an old friend and fellow law partner, is going nuts over the Sanders ruling. I turn off my machine, and without thinking, I dial Skye's number. As I hear her phone ringing, I figure I'll invite her for a coffee. With closed eyes, I listen to her recorded voice. This is the Lindemeyer family. We're not home right now. When the machine beeps, I hang up. I know that I will not be able to control myself in the future. I tear the phone number out of the investigator's information sheet, rip it into little pieces, and throw it out the window. All I need is a simple surveillance job. I ponder hiring Ron for the task, just a slice-of-life tape. But I realize that only I can find the 360 degrees of her character. Only I would know what to look for, the glimmer in her smile, the twinkle in her eye. Her work address says Mercy Hospital in Franklin Square Township. Instead of driving, I call Long Island Railroad. They give me a schedule of trains leaving tomorrow for West Hempstead. I pop a couple of sleeping pills, fold my arms across my chest, and move into my coffin. To die, to sleep. Upon waking up, washing, and dressing the next morning, I grab my Sony camcorder, my CD Walkman playing Eminem, a break from opera. I subway it downtown to Prozac Station, where I purchase a ticket for the Huntington train. I take a seat on the 1028 from track 17 and put on my headphones. A little blonde girl, not much older than 8, is seated in front of me. She looks timidly at a middle-aged lawyer across from her reading the New York Times. That man, bland in appearance, diabolic in intent, is me. Her mother turns her away. 15 years from now, who will that girl be? If she develops a shapely body and becomes Sky when she turns 18, will she become Jean Lindemeyer 15 years later? People assume that just because one is out of control, they are also unaware of it. Before grief, lechery, and even courage broke me out of my maximum security of reason, what was I? In 1979, I was someone who believed pursuing Sky was an artistic, even redemptive endeavor. I was someone who believed what he saw. A nice conductor is handing the little girl a lollipop. Noticing me, he winks. I give the fellow scumbag a wink back.